As soon as I waved back, they peeled off and began doing figure eights around each other. I gasped. Then began a ballet in space. I heard a faint but familiar melody coming from the speaker system in our craft. It was the sound of three flutes playing a light-hearted melody. It sounded so very familiar. It was the dance of the Merlitons, or reed flutes, from the Nutcracker Suite. Straight ahead of me were three tiny balls of light, braiding themselves together. They came closer and the lights grew larger. As the flutes soared up the scale, the three lights split apart into an arc over our heads and became full-fledged saucers with flaring lights. Each one moved in a small circle of swirling light. As the flute tones descended, they came back together in tight formation and stopped right in front of our window. As the flutes played a staccato phrase, one of the saucers blinked in time with the music. Then at the next staccato phrase the one beside it blinked its lights, and finally the last staccato phrase was accented by the third craft's lights. It was altogether charming. They looked for all the world like three little kids, each one saying in turn, "Look at me." As the music repeated itself, the dance in space began again. This light-hearted piece of music is one of the shortest pieces of classical music there is. As it came to a sudden end, the three saucers came at us head-on, two swerved sharply to each side and one went overhead. Then they disappeared. I was stunned and could only gasp at the beauty and imagination of it all. They had certainly made sure I wouldn't feel alone while out in space. Bian watched my reaction with delight and so did Simon. "Nice job, Kuhn," said Simon. Then I heard the suave and majestic phrasing of the Nutcracker Suite's Waltz of the Flowers. At the harp introduction, the same three ships trailed their lights across our vision, weaving a beautiful web of different colors. As the waltz actually began, a new starship appeared, and popped its lights on. The lights turned up and you could see a number of beams around the circular edge. At the next phrase, another starship appeared and popped its lights on. As each new musical phrase announced itself, another one of the round wingless craft appeared in front of us with circlets of light projected upwards. There was now a whole garden of flowers in space, swaying in an invisible wind. As the music developed into a crescendo, the flowers opened more fully but with lights still turned upward. They truly danced for us. They even had a single light coining out the bottom of each of the craft to imitate a stem. The flowers of space were all around us. Suddenly I saw a beam of lights from our own starship. Then I knew that we were no longer just observers in an audience but that we had become part of the dance as well. It was grand and glorious. I was caught up in it, swirling in a euphoria and ecstasy I had never known before. There was a tangible upwelling of joy in all the beings inside our starship, and it pulsed in from the other starships as well. It was truly otherworldly. As the music ended, the starships all turned their lights toward us, dimmed them a little and executed a bow. Then they wound themselves together into a thick braid of lights and disappeared into the distance. I was entranced. Then I recovered enough to clap and say, "Bravo! Bravo! Bravo!" They were wonderful. "I'm glad you liked our little surprise," said Bian. "Unbelievable. I never stop being amazed on my visits here to the mothership. Thank you so much for sharing it with me. No one down on Earth could possibly imagine such a grand and heavenly spectacle." I shook my head. "They are all hung upon the UFO abduction scenario instead of being curious about something like this. This is the first time I have ever taken an Earthling for a ride in our craft, Katria." Simon chuckled. "You've got nothing on me. This is the first time I have ever ridden in a saucer aircraft. I managed to get out. It's really a very soft ride, Bian. There's no vibration, no sense of gravity pushing you one way or another like in an aircraft. And I didn't even see you do anything with the controls." Bian's hands rested lightly on the control panel, but she turned slightly towards me. "As I said, the majority of our flight is controlled by thought. But it is important for you in the context of your earthly experience, that you are able to see and believe what we are doing." I nodded, glad that she understood how difficult it was sometimes to comprehend all of the new things I encountered. The mothership appeared to be closing in overhead, but I knew, of course, that it was actually our saucer aircraft that was lowering towards it. Reference points are hard to find out in space. That's enough for today. I don't want to shock your sensibilities too much at first, she said. We eased through the great doors of the mothership without so much as a ripple or a shudder. Then it came to rest again on our tripod. It's like being a great big bird. You feel that you are in command of the skies. I was thinking out loud. Yes, of course it is. It's really a joyful experience to fly the craft. She turned around in her seat to face me. Katria, wouldn't you like to learn to control this craft? Oh, I don't know about that. I've ridden in military helicopters on Earth. They vibrate like all get out. They have so many dials I couldn't comprehend them all. The pilot hardly moved anything with his feet and hands, but the copter just skittered over the landscape. It was all beyond me. I shook my head. Yes, those helicopters do have lots of gadgets to tell you what you are doing. I knew she was trying to suppress a smile, but I didn't really mind. Once we get the power supply started here in our craft, we just use our minds to keep track of what's going on. It's ever so much easier with thought than with all those dowels and things. Come, sit up here. She stood tip and motioned to her seat. Simon will work with you, Lai will run the mechanical part of the operation while you learn about the woman's part in controlling the craft by thought. I sat there locked in my seat. No, I can't. I might crash it into the wall or something. I shook my head. No, you wouldn't. There are pads of energy around the walls that would hold you off of them. Try it, she urged gently. I just shook my head. In truth, I was afraid. Fly a saucer aircraft. I didn't have the faintest idea how to do it. Suddenly I heard the booming voice of Adros, the commander of the mothership. How did you enjoy your first ride in one of our scout craft, Katria? His voice must have come from a speaker system somewhere inside the craft, I decided. Then I saw the tall frame of the commander of the mothership, walking through the hangar area toward the craft. He seemed to be able to pop in anywhere. He was smiling too. Oh yes. It was a wonderful ride, sir. There was no sense weight or gravity at all, and the performance of the other ship was beyond belief. I never imagined anything could be so beautiful. Then I scrunched down in my seat, silent for a moment. Now Bian wants me to try to sit in her pilot's seat and try to fly it myself. My voice was barely a whisper. I don't think I could do that. I was very nervous. I think I'd better stay in the healing center where I know what I am doing. It's true, you do good work in the healing center, but we need you to do more kinds of work than just what you do in the healing center, Katria. We need you to learn to fly our craft as well. My eyes opened wide as Lai stood on a platform outside the window looking in at me. The reason that the mothership operates so well is because our people have many different talents. Whenever anyone goes by an area where something needs to be done, they know what to do immediately. He cocked his head. Don't you remember down in Earth space, that there is something called cross-training? We need you to learn to fly one of our saucer aircraft. We really do, but I'm all Earthling, I protested. Yes, but there is no reason why you can't learn to fly the saucer aircraft. You have the idea that because you were born on Earth that learning this task is impossible. That's not true. In your life on Earth you have had many limitations programmed into you. You are often told, you can't do this, you can't do that. Release those mistaken ideas now, and just believe. I wanted to, but I was frozen in my seat. I'm afraid, I whispered. Adros chided me gently. Now Katria, you have never met anything here in our mothership that you need to be afraid of, now, have you? That's true. I shook my head. Fear does not become you, Katria. His voice was firm. It is time to let go of fear. Nothing can hurt you tip here on the mothership. Remember, you are here in your astral body. You need have no fear for your physical body. It cannot be hurt by what you do up here. We actually need you to learn to fly the saucer aircraft. There may come a time when you would be the only OTAR around. Lai Zero would be available to go out on a scouting mission. He paused for emphasis. We have trained others from Earth who are part of our Pleiadian family to fly these scout craft. You are even acquainted with one such person down in Earth space. Of course he doesn't run around telling people he can do this. But here on the mothership we need all the talent we can get. We need you too. If we didn't believe that you could be trusted with the saucer aircraft, Bayhat Alice would never have asked you to sit in the pilot's seat. Oh. Was all I could say. All right sir, if you really think I can do it, I will. I would have to set my fear aside to do my best to lend what it was that they needed for me to do. Bian stood aside and swept her hand graciously toward the seat. I sat down gingerly. The seat enfolded me, and a surtise of comfort surrounded me. It felt very friendly, like a great yellow cat winding around my feet, if such a thing was possible. There were handprints on the console. Gingerly I laid my hands on them. Now think about rising up off the tripod, say about 6 feet or so, said Bian. Very slowly I thought about rising. To help me concentrate I imagined I was a great eagle that stood up and stretched its wings before launching from a tree or its nest. It worked. The saucer aircraft had risen inside the hangar to just off its tripod. Now ease back down, into your nest if you like, said Bian. I imagined the eagle's knees buckling tundra to dropping down onto the nest and felt a soft bump as we met the tripod again. Very good. You kept your mind focused on what you were doing. If you hadn't, the craft would have behaved erratically. Next time you come to visit the mothership, we will show you how your mind can actually control objects. We have a special learning center for this, and we start with very small objects at first. You'll like it. It is a fun place to play. She smiled from ear to ear. That's what I liked about Bian. When she smiled, the whole room lit up. She was always filled with joy. Bian was right about the learning center for the mind. There was a room full of small objects to play with. It was as much fun as falling into a tub full of balls of foam such as is found in many shopping malls at home on Earth. It was truly an experience without limitations. You could dive right into a box of such balls and move objects out of the way simply with your mind. No bruises, no bumps along the way. Some of the toys were also small birds. It was fun to make a bird rise up and fly around the room, just by thinking about it, making it swoop and dive. Now try two at a time, I heard Bian say. She had come by to check my progress in the learning center for the mind. Have them dip and sway alternately just as birds do in their migration patterns. This was a little more difficult and I had to concentrate a bit more, giving instructions to each bird form my mind. Now try adding another one, she said. And so it went. Each visit to the mothership I spent part of the time playing with my birds, sometimes making one of them stay up in the air while I influenced others into circling around each other in mock battles. Other times I sat in the comfort chair which actually had controls built into all parts of it. The back, the arms, the seat actually had controls built into all parts of it. More in book. End of this part. Then some from chapter 18. This is critical time, but if you have gotten a good grounding of information in the book, then your memory will come up with what is needed to write down on the test. Fear should be avoided as it puts up a mental block. So often the students themselves cultivate this fear, supposedly to make themselves and others study the material. More often their learning is blocked at that point. Gradually there are classes where there are more exercises in independent thinking. These are most often begun in your literature classes with such questions as, why do you think that character decided to do that? Unfortunately, some students try to avoid this type of thinking as they don't see the value of it, but this is where they begin to develop the skills indeed to live a successful life. This is where a moral code begins to be installed in the student, and the student observes different ways that a character may solve problems. At this time, it is very beneficial to have a low student-to-teacher ratio so that all members of the class can be encouraged to participate. This is usually when the student is 9 to 12 years old. Learning doesn't just take place in the classroom. It takes place in the schoolyard, and in the neighborhood as well. When you are growing up, if the adults around you are willing to discuss how people get along, and what a sense of fair play means to an organized society, Then the student can learn to become a productive member of society. Unfortunately, there are also bad teachers in the community. They may be the peers of the student and teach them how to steal from others, or how to bully someone else. It is important that adults work hard to keep this kind of teaching away from the children. Otherwise, the student may stall out at that level and later end up in a jail somewhere. But we don't want to be discussing that right now. At what you call your university level, there is a continuation of a certain amount of book learning. However, a really good teacher encourages students to do independent thinking on a subject of their own interest. This can be an exciting and rewarding time for both students and their teachers. Students are encouraged to learn how to research a subject of their choice on an independent basis. More and more, the teacher tries to stay in the background, allowing the student to set their own pace. The teacher only steps in when the student appears to be heading down a blind alley. Sometimes they are thrilled to see a student make a breakthrough into new ideas or a new technology. So far, you are all acquainted with the types of teaching I have mentioned. The measure of success for this kind of student is a sheepskin printed with varying degrees. It is awarded in a formal ceremony on the university campus to a student who is wearing a cap and gown. They are allowed to proclaim their level of knowledge by adding these degrees to their name. I nodded my head. Yes, I am familiar with everything that you have described, Commander Eldrose, I said. There is another type of learning where you don't get a sheepskin with abbreviated degrees. However, when you complete your learning, you are equipped to live a life of confidence and power. The native peoples of the earth excel at this type of teaching. There will be one person whom the tribe calls a medicine person. Most of the people have no idea what it is that he does and how he can accomplish healings, even at a distance. Some of his information is kept secret because it would not be expected if it became common knowledge. There will come a young man or a young woman to the medicine person who will request to apply to become an apprentice. Usually the medicine person is well aware of the young person long before they make the formal request. Because the medicine person's training can be long and arduous, they may want to make sure that the applicant, candidate, can stand up to the physical, emotional and mental tests, which will be required down the road. Instead of being sympathetic, the medicine person might appear to be gruff and confront the student with the idea that maybe they don't have the determination to stick with the training. The student needs to decide right then if the information is important enough for them to learn so they can stand against the difficulties of the teaching methods which the medicine person will put before them. It will be a tough course because the medicine person will expect them to search their soul for their purity of spirit and search their soul for the physical stamina they will need. If they decide not to become the student of the medicine man, there is no condemnation for turning away. However, once the training is beginning, it can be rigorous for body, mind and spirit. The student will gradually begin to learn how to use the very stuff of the universe to manifest something into visible form. Then they will learn how to work with invisible energies. Herein lies the secret of learning how to heal, first oneself and then others in the community. They may assist the medicine person in healing ceremonies both for individuals and for the larger coin in Limtian, which he or she lives. Among other things the medicine person will teach the student is to find their own inner teacher. The shift is gentle at first. Gradually they will demand that the student not always fall back on an outer teacher such as him, herself. They may even try to provoke the student in various ways in order to give the student strength of purpose. Once the students have learned their topics with the mind, their tests will become physically arduous. They will test the body's physical stamina and the spirit's determination. They will learn to take the phrase, "I can't" out of their vocabulary because they will learn to be creative in learning how to accomplish their assigned tasks. Midway in their training, the medicine person will often disappear so that the student can learn their own strengths and observe their own weaknesses. In addition, the medicine person may have another student or two and simply is unable to devote all their time to one student. They may become gruff and unyielding. This is intended to gradually wean the student away from depending on the teacher at all times. It is at this time that the student must look for their inner teacher. As you know, Native Americans have a test called the Vision Quest. The student is trained in various ways. They prepare their body by fasting and are taught self-discipline in various ways. Then the student spends 2 or 3 days alone at a location of their choice. When they are deprived of sensory input from other human beings, they must confront themselves, their inner weaknesses, overcome fear, and learn to trust their inner teacher. Then one day the student will understand that their earthly teacher has given them great freedom to explore the world and even become a co-creator with God. Adros paused to let this information sink in with the considerable audience that had gathered around to listen. The very air had become electric. Then his face softened. Katriya, you and the other earthlings who have been brought up here to the mothership to be in our classes have the opportunity to learn of technology, which is not generally available nor yet in existence on planet Earth. It very well could become available, but the time is not yet arrived for it to be released safely to all the residents of Earth. Some members of humanity would misuse it just as they have misused the power of the atom for destruction. This cannot be allowed and will not be allowed. But you who are in our classrooms are being given this information because your hearts have been examined and it had been determined that you would not misuse it. When we teach you this high-level technical information, we must also provide a protection for you. There are those upon your earth who would come and take you from your home by force and threaten you or even torture you to get you to release this information to them. They might even use what is called truth serum to find out what they wanted to know. So in order to protect you from this, the information you are learning has been programmed to go into your cellular memory, but you may have no conscious memory of it being there. Then when the time comes that Earth has become the peaceable planet it is ultimately to be, the veils over this knowledge will be peeled back and it will be there for you and others to use for the welfare of the Earth. Until then, we ask you to just accept that it is there and do not be disturbed if you cannot remember what tonight's class has been about. Thank you, sir. That was my concern, because I felt that my memory was failing me and I didn't want to let you down. I sighed. Now, Katriya, there is something that I want you to do, said Adros. You have visited here many nights. I had suggested that you go to your computer and write about the stories of your visits with us. Now I am calling my instructions to you. I am saying that you must do this. You will be able to describe our people and the technology that you have witnessed in action in a way that will be understandable to the people of Earth. You will be able to keep the jargon out of it. This I am asking you to do. No, I am demanding that you do it. This will be your gift to the people of Earth, to tell them of their brothers and sisters from the Pleiades and other star systems who inhabit the great motherships above the Earth. But I am afraid of what people will say if I write these stories. Many people who have told about extraterrestrials have had terrible things happen to them. There is no longer any need for you to be afraid, Katriya. None at all. Adros shook his head. His eyes on me were a piercing blue. This was my assignment. Adros had given it to me and nothing would change it. This message was given to me by Adros in late April of 1991. Many times down here in Earth space I would go to the computer, but I always found a way to stall writing the whole book. Eventually 4 of these stories were published in Connecting Link magazine, but my courage only came in little bits and pieces, until now. Those of you who have been drawn to read this book, in all likelihood have been up on the mothership in classes too. The information I have furnished in this book should help you remove fear and doubt. Then you should also be able to peel away the veils from your memory and recognize the truth of these experiences. Chapter 19, Mission in Space: Terraforming a Half-Dead Planet, or Getting Life Back to the Physical Dimension of Mars. Many times as I drove home from visiting Earthside friends, it would be late in the evening. I would see the Pleiadian mothership that was stationed high above the Earth, just beyond our gravitational field. Often there were sister ships nearby in other quadrants of the sky. Somehow I just knew they were there. I didn't need a star map to know that they were the anomalies in the night sky. Most of the time they would appear starting about 12:30 at night. Sometimes these small scout craft were still playing long past 2 o'clock in the morning. I guess they chose those times to lift their screens of invisibility because of the timing of our workforce here on Earth. The night shift workers would have just checked into their jobs and the second shift of workers would have just had time to get home and inside their house. Supposedly the only earthlings left outside would be those who frequented the bars and who would believe them if they said they had seen spacecraft in the heavens? I had to chuckle at the cleverness of these Blairdeans. But my ship was always directly overhead. When I would get home and step out of the car, I would look up, wave and call out softly, "Hi, fellas. I'll be up there soon." Almost always I heard a telepathic return greeting along with a flashing pattern of lights. I grinned, "That isn't a star twinkling. No star ever sends out signals like that." I would settle myself in bed. I put my right toes over the top of my left foot, with the toes just overlapping and clasped my fingers comfortably together. This connected the electromagnetic energies in my body, allowing them to recirculate in a smooth flow. Then I did my best to still my mind, concentrate on the mothership overhead and drift into that hypnotic state between sleep and wakefulness that was most conducive to astral travel up to the mothership. There were many times during my nighttime visits to the mothership that I had a chance to play at flying the saucer aircraft that belonged to the mothership. Once you settled into the pilot's seat, that I called the comfort chair that almost seemed to be alive, the saucer aircraft responded to your thought instantaneously. It was more fun than a children's slide, better than the loop-the-loop, and more star-born than a giant Ferris wheel. More than once when I was in the saucer aircraft I would catch myself saying we's during our maneuvers and dives, much to the amusement of Simon or another Pleiadian man who acted as my teammate in the saucer aircraft. Such play was encouraged for it developed confidence and faith in what you and the craft could do together. One evening I was summoned to a place I hadn't seen before on the mothership. It appeared much like an Earthside operations center. A man in a special aviator's jumpsuit began a briefing. He looked to be about 35, and had a military bearing about him. He began speaking, "Welcome everyone. We have a mission coming up soon that needs to be performed in your solar system where Earth resides. We will have only a short time, perhaps only a few hours in which to work. We need you folks to be in position at the same time as other flight crews. There will be 6 teams that will be set in position around the planet." I wondered idly if there were earthquakes they were hoping to hold at bay, such as I had heard of them doing for Earth before. "No, this will not be a mission to your planet, little Earthling," the briefer grinned. He had heard my thought. "Earth will not be in the middle of the operation, not this time. Then we will have 6 other operational teams to be put in position around one of the moons of another planet." I soon forgot my concern about Earth. We were outfitted with aviator-style jumpsuits with lots of pockets. Then we were fitted with a special helmet. Although I knew it would have a radio and mic, the first time I put it on, I was not prepared to hear what came out of the earphones as I supped them over my head. "Goody Thompson, it has been said that you made Farmer Brown's bucket of milk turn sour while it was sitting on his porch. What do you have to say for yourself?" The male voice was strident and accusing. "I was only walking by his house, that's all. I go that way to pick herbs up in the hills to use for healing. I didn't even know he had a bucket of milk on his porch." The woman's voice was soft and a little bit amused in spite of the tone of her accuser's voice. "That's enough," the man screamed. "We know what to do with the likes of you here in Salem. You better watch your tongue or it will be the water test for you." I turned to look at the speaker on the wall. I was shocked out of the time and space where we were. It sounded like we were back 3 centuries ago into some of the more unsavory historical periods of Earth, in New England. A technician on my left reached forward quickly, flipped a switch and the sound disappeared. He blushed and shrugged his shoulders. "Sorry about that. Sometimes we like to listen to documentaries telling about the superstitions which existed on your Earth in its past. We just happened to hit on one from your country." It was my turn to squirm. Most of us aren't very proud of that time period. There were women who were healers, herbalists I believe, and other people who were trying to do a lot of good who were killed during this insane period of one history. Now I inspected the helmet I was to wear. It was a funny looking thing. In addition to the mic and earphones, it looked like it had big ears on it. What is this? Am I to be an elephant? I was informed that the ears were actually two small video cameras that would be broadcasting back to the command ship when the operation got underway.